Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Wednesday, February 10th, 2021. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Midland Health: Providing Vaccines to Region is Important, by Stuart Doreen. Midland Health CEO Russell Myers said Tuesday that an important part of the mass vaccination effort taking place is the responsibility to counties around Midland. Myers explained during the Midland United Command Team press conference that officials from Midland Health, the Midland Fire Department and EMS, and volunteers have made arrangements to serve those in the 17-county region where Midland sits, called Trauma Service Area J by the state. Last week, that meant providing 190 vaccines in Garden City. On Monday, there were 405 vaccinations administered in Fort Davis. On Tuesday, officials were in Marfa, intending to deliver 500 doses to the residents of the northern part of Presidio County. We have a huge geographical area, including some very sparsely populated counties that have very little healthcare infrastructure, Meyer said. Doses have also been provided to health officials in Presidio, Howard County, and Martin County, Russell Meyer said. In fact, Midland Health statistics show the vaccine distribution through Monday was 22,439. Of that, a total of 3,360 doses have been transferred to Big Bend Regional, Martin County Hospital, Presidio County Health Services, Scenic Mountain, West Texas Allergy in Midland, Graham's Pharmacy in Midland, and HEB in Central Midland. Midland Health's vaccine administration included 12,245 at the Horseshoe Complex and 5,510 for healthcare employees. Others include vaccination administration at or for Casa de Amigos, Encompass Rehab, The Field's Edge, Manor Park, Midland Christian, Midland ISD, the Southeast Senior Center, Senior Life, Senior Link, and Trinity. We will be talking tomorrow and later on this week about what the next round of regional distribution might look like as we accumulate more doses as the state's pattern of allocation to us becomes clearer, Meyer said. We think we will be able to share some more doses with those in need around the region. We're looking forward to doing that. It was noted during the press conference that people from outside the region and as far away as places like the Metroplex are coming to Midland for vaccine. It was stated the efficiency of the operations at the Horseshoe was a reason for the attention efforts here are receiving. Meyer said people from 50 to 60 zip codes have come to the Horseshoe for vaccines. The state has given us direction from the very beginning, as they've given to other hubs, not to be overly concerned with people's residences, Meyer said. If they come to us for a vaccine, if they want to schedule with us, and if they meet the criteria, we will schedule them. We're not encouraging that. Our vaccine is primarily to be given to the people here in this region. That's how it gets allocated. But if somebody from Dallas ends up on our schedule, we're not going to turn them away just because of where they live. Vaccines to the region administered: Garden City, 190, Fort Davis, 405, Marfa, 500. Transfers: Big Bend Regional, Alpine, Brewster County, 600, Martin County, 696, Presidio County Health Services, 402, Scenic Mountain, 798. This article is entitled City to Create Assistance Program for Landlords Hurt by Pandemic, by Caitlin Randall. The Midland City Council on Tuesday approved creating an assistance program for landlords whose tenants are not paying rent because of the COVID-19 pandemic and economic downturn. Council member Lori Blong said she added the item to Tuesday's meeting agenda after being contacted by local property owners. A lot of folks who rent properties in and around Midland and throughout the nation, frankly, are not paying rent because they know they can't be evicted, she said during the meeting. And they're not availing themselves of the rental programs that exist because they're not incentivized to go to those programs. A federal eviction moratorium was issued by the CDC in September and is in effect until March 31st. There's speculation the moratorium will be extended before it expires. Blong said some of the landlords she's spoken to are unable to pay their mortgages and are at risk of losing their properties because their renters are several months behind on payments. It's creating a scenario where some of the property owners are not going to be able to make their property tax payments, those that have mortgages are having trouble meeting those mortgage requirements, and they still have no mechanism to require the renter to pay, she said. As it was proposed, the program would use funds from the city's existing rental assistance program. The council previously allocated $800,000 to be used toward rental assistance, and about $335,000 of those funds have been used. However, community development manager Isaac Garnett expressed concern during Tuesday's meeting about expanding funds that were allocated for rental assistance to include property owners. The money the council allocated for rental assistance was a mix of CDBG funds and federal CARES funding, Garnett said. He said those funds are subject to different requirements, and the Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs may ask the city to pay back the CDBG grants if given to landlords. In order for us to stay out of trouble, we have to be very careful how we proceed, he said. The council instructed Garnett and the city planning staff to look for a way to create the program without using CDBG funding and to establish guidelines for participating in the program. If city planning staff determine it's not feasible, the program will not move forward. This article is entitled Time to Plan for Valentine's Day at Local Eateries by J.C. Lewis. Make Valentine's Day easy by planning ahead, especially when it comes to reserving dinner plans, because Valentine's Day is on a Sunday this year. There are also options for more laid-back dinner options in this special edition of Small Bites. Opal's Table will be open Saturday from 5 to 9:30 p.m., and on Sunday, Valentine's Sunday Special will feature Hearts of Palm with kale, blue cheese, candied walnuts, and onion, truffled tomato soup with grilled bread and wine, pairing of the snitch by Prisoner for the first course. The second course will be wild-caught salmon with pearl onions, peas, and lobster sauce, a fillet with potato gratin, asparagus, green peppercorn sauce with wine, parking of Corazon del Sol Malbec. Dessert will be chocolate cake with vanilla bean ice cream, strawberry puree, chocolate ganache, meringue, berry compote, whipped cream, and angel's food cake with champagne toast. Reservations can be made at opalstable.com. Alley Village Butter will be open from 11 a.m. to midnight Saturday and from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Sunday. The restaurant will also have a Valentine's Day 8-course meal with Tall City Brewing Company beer pairings. The event will be 6 to 9 p.m. at Tall City Brewing Company. Tickets can be purchased at tallcitybrewing.com/event. To make weekend reservations at Alley Village Butter, call 853-2625 or email reservations at buttermidland.com. Wall Street Bar and Grill will be open from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. Saturday and from 10 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Sunday. The restaurant does not take reservations. The Garlic Press will be open the week of Valentine's Day, including Sunday. Enjoy a dinner with wine and delicious desserts. Make reservations by calling 570-4020. Venezia's restaurant is open from 5 to 9 p.m. Saturday and Sunday. The menu features many seafood options, desserts, and a variety of wine. Make reservations at veneziarestaurant.info/reservations-events or by calling 687-0900. Cork and Pig Tavern is the newest restaurant in Alley Village. The restaurant will be open 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. Saturday and 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Sunday. Reservations can be made at opentable.com/cork-and-pig-tavern-alley-village-midland. Librado is open on Saturdays and Sundays. The local restaurant serves a seafood tower made of two lobster tails, seared scallops, jumbo shrimp, live little neck clams, live mussels, and crispy calamari. Reservations can be made at libradomidland.com or by calling 218-7260. Luigi's Italian Restaurant is open from 5 to 8:30 p.m. Saturday. The eatery, located in the heart of downtown, makes for a nice escape with Italian food. Pie Social is open from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. Saturday and from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Sundays. Couples can share a pizza and cocktails and then enjoy a nice stroll in Centennial Park afterwards. Bean and Grape is open from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday and 10 a.m. on Sunday. Bean and Grape serves different small plates and sliders, perfect for grazing while trying exploring for the extensive wine list. Volcano Sushi is open 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. Saturday and 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Sunday. The restaurant serves more than sushi with menu items such as pad thai, ramen, and more. Murray's Deli has started serving pizzas on Fridays and Saturdays. Open 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. on Friday and 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Saturday. Visit the iconic Midland restaurant or order for curbside pickup. Sapporo Ramen and Grill is open 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. Saturday and 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Sunday. Customers can enjoy ramen, pepper rice, dumplings with cocktails and beers. Oppa Korean Restaurant has brought Korean food to Midland and serves a variety of wine options, including bread and butter. The restaurant is open 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Saturday and 11 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. Sunday. This is the local page. Bowling Bingo Event at Centennial Park. Keep Midland Beautiful is hosting a bowling and bingo event at Centennial Park on President's Day. Children of all ages can enjoy activities of bowling and bingo on Monday starting at 1:30 p.m. Attendees can have fun with reused items on the north promenade of the park. There will be prizes for participants. Youth will also learn the importance and accessibility of recycling and reusing household items with bowling and bingo. MISD School Quality Survey now open. MISD is conducting a school quality survey that will gather feedback about its schools from district parents and guardians, employees, and students in grades 3 to 12. The survey is part of the district's commitment to becoming a system of great schools and providing every student with the best possible education. Survey questions address academic support, student support, safety and behavior, school leadership, and family involvement. The survey will open through February 26th. Employees, parents, and guardians will receive an email invitation and survey link. Paper surveys will be available at MISD Central Office, located at 615 West Missouri Avenue. Students in grades 3 to 12 will take the survey at school. Heart and Soul Run. The Midland YMCA Heart and Soul Run will take place February 20th at the downtown location, 800 North Big Spring Street. The event will include a kids' 1K fun run, a 5K, and a 10K. Contact Maddie Meyer at 682-2551 for more information or email mmeyer at MidlandYMCA.org. Library hours. Centennial Branch, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday. 2503 West Loop 250, 742-7400. Downtown Branch, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday to Friday, and 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, at 301 West Missouri Avenue, 688-4320. Contact your representative. Midland Memorial Hospital, 400 Roslyn Redfern Grover Parkway, Midland, 79701. Phone 221-1111. Website www.midland-memorial.com. Facebook www.facebook.com/Midland Memorial Hospital. Twitter twitter.com/Midland Memorial. President Russell Myers, 221-1584. Directors, District 1, Tracy Green. District 2, Dwayne Tomlin. District 3, Larry Mercer. District 4, Link Grimes. District 5, Carrie Chaplin. District 6, Antonio Miramontes. District 7, Jeffrey Beard. Lottery numbers. All or nothing morning. 1, 0, 5, 0, 7, 0, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 16, 17, 24. All or nothing day. 4, 0, 5, 0, 8, 0, 9, 10, 11, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 22. All or nothing evening. 1, 0, 3, 0, 5, 0, 6, 0, 7, 12, 13, 15, 16, 18, 22, 23. Daily 4, morning. 5, 6, 0, 2. Fireball 1. Daily 4 day. 3, 2, 4, 7. Fireball 7. Daily 4 evening. 0, 6, 0, 2. Fireball 7. Pick 3 morning. 5, 9, 4. Fireball 3. Pick 3 day. 0, 4, 3. Fireball 8. Pick 3 evening, 093, Fireball 2. Weather. Forecast for Wednesday, February 10th, 2021. Tuesday's temperatures, high 57, low 28, normal high 61, normal low 33. February 9th, records, high 88, said in 1932, low 7, said in 2011. Precipitation, Monday 0, Tuesday 0, month total 0, year total 0.36 inch, normal total year to date 0.78 inch. Average wind speed 7.6 miles per hour, highest wind speed 15 miles an hour, highest gust speed 19 miles per hour. Forecast for Wednesday, February 10th in Midland. Partly cloudy, highs of 66, lows of 31. This is the opinion page. A tax break for paying your taxes? Please. By Megan McArdle, Washington Post Writers Group. Washington. There's no real defense of the federal deduction for state and local taxes. The SALT deduction, as it's known to accountants, needlessly complicates the tax code and lowers federal revenue by billions of dollars. Since, over the long run, federal spending must bear some relationship to revenue, sooner or later we will either need to cut benefits or raise taxes on other people. And most Americans are considerably less affluent than the beneficiaries of the SALT deduction, who are among our nation's richest citizens and live in our richest zip codes. Because so few lower-income taxpayers itemize deductions, some 96% of the SALT benefit flows to the top 20% of households. The deduction becomes more valuable as your tax rate climbs, so more than half the benefit accrues to the top 1%. Fully a quarter benefits people in the top 0.1% of household incomes. With rare exceptions, if you are worried that you can't deduct your state and local taxes, you don't just live in a high tax state, you make a whole lot of money. Nonetheless, when a 2017 tax law capped this deduction at $10,000, Democrats began agitating almost immediately to repeal the cap. President Biden was barely inaugurated when they started pushing again to include it in the latest relief bill. With all the suffering in the land, won't someone think of the rich? That's not quite how they put it, of course. The words race to the bottom get thrown around a lot, the implication being that since state and local taxes mostly go to the needy, removing the subsidy will drive affluent Americans to lower tax states, in effect defunding the folks who need the help the most. Yet, if you look at the top tax burden in each state, the relationship between tax collection and service quality isn't so clear. Are the poor in high-tax District of Columbia a third better cared for than those in neighboring Maryland? How does middle-of-the-road Massachusetts manage to provide such excellent services while taking less than 10% of its citizens' personal income, while New York State requires nearly 14%? Or are we subsidizing inefficient government, like New York's highest-in-the-world transit construction costs? Other funds get spent on things that mostly benefit locals, like streets and sidewalks. It would be hard to argue people in other states should pay for those things, especially if they didn't largely live in places with lower incomes than New York, New Jersey, or California. At this point, SALT's boosters often retort that blue states subsidize red states, so SALT deductions just readjust the balance a little. There are red states among the net donors to the Treasury, and many blue states are among the most subsidized. However, those imbalances are largely a product of things most of SALT's boosters support, such as federal employment and progressive transfer programs such as Social Security. Given that most of SALT's cheerleaders also support making the overall system even more progressive, it's odd to see them suddenly arguing for giving special tax breaks to the rich. But Democratic leaders must pander to a special group of voters, rich people who don't feel very rich. Probably, if you are reading this article, you are one of them. I am, too. We tend to sincerely believe two things. Rich people should pay more taxes, and we ourselves need more tax breaks because we're barely getting by. Sure, we may make a comfortable income, but we had to borrow every last penny the bank would authorize just to get the ugliest house in a good school district. Many of us end up living paycheck to paycheck when property taxes or tuition bills come in, and our vacations never involve words like luxury villa or private jet. How can we be rich, no matter what the household income charts say? Yet the harder truth is that we really are spending our large incomes on luxuries, in the sense that very few people can enjoy the things we are paying for. Close access to a dynamic urban economy with deep labor markets, lots of cultural amenities, and most importantly, near guaranteed access for our kids to an elite college education and the kinds of elite jobs that require those degrees. We tend to think of those things as bare necessities, but most Americans do without them. We also forget that we choose to pay those inflated costs because access to what those cities offer is valuable and what we want. We should be grateful we can afford it, instead of looking enviously at people living somewhere else. Or, if we're really struggling, we could press the governments we elect to cut down on the absurd feather bedding built into roads, bridges, and transit projects, and the restrictive building codes that make new housing so expensive, and other excesses. That would certainly be more defensible than trying to revive the SALT deduction so people who made different choices can subsidize the high cost of enjoying our privileges. This column is called Guest View. It is entitled, Ending Drilling on Federal Land Isn't Going to Stop Oil Consumption, from the Dallas Morning News. Most Americans, in fact nearly all Americans, get around using vehicles that use gasoline. And nearly all of our goods are delivered in trucks that use diesel. If there's no fuel, those vehicles don't magically start running on water or banana peels or old gym socks or any other substance, natural or man-made. This is a hard, difficult truth that Americans must absorb as the White House seeks to cut greenhouse gas pollution that comes from burning fossil fuels. The administration is putting a fair amount of energy into strategies that do not support that stated goal. Among these is President Joe Biden's executive order to halt leasing on federal lands for oil and gas production. If America produces less oil, drivers will still fill their tanks, only with fuel made from oil produced somewhere else. Biden last week announced a set of executive orders designed to meet the goal of significantly and quickly reducing carbon dioxide emissions that contribute to climate change. Among the orders is a directive to the Department of Interior to pause all oil and gas leasing on federal lands until the department can review its fossil fuel leasing policies. Reviewing policies is a good move. Halting leasing is not. Search Google for maps of federal land, and you will find images of the U.S. that look like someone took a paintbrush to the western half of the country and ran out of paint at the Rocky Mountains. Federal land includes much more than national parks and forest preserves. In the western states, not Texas, most land belongs to the government, and the money generated by those lands goes to federal and state coffers. Further, federal land contributes a chunk of total U.S. oil and gas production. According to the American Petroleum Institute, federal land, both onshore and offshore, in 2019 contributed about 22% of total U.S. oil production and 12% of natural gas production. About 70% of federal oil production comes from offshore. Halting leasing won't immediately halt production, as oil and gas companies operate existing wells and drill on leases already in hand. But zero leasing means production will most likely begin to taper off, and the ultimate decline will depend on how long the moratorium remains. That's a sad way to punish oil companies and their employees, plus the communities throughout the West that support them. Oil companies faced losses that will go down in the history books in 2020 as the pandemic-related recession reduced oil and gas consumption. And many have already cut back production anyhow before the leasing moratorium. That makes 2021 a pretty good time for the government to review its leasing policies, but a terrible time to halt leasing. We join the Texas members of Biden's own Democratic Party in recommending he allow leasing to continue. And we join the White House in asking the Interior Department to review oil and gas leasing policies, but to do so after a period of public comment. A series of public forums throughout the affected states where local people can weigh in would be welcome. This column is entitled Race is On to Produce the Cleanest Fossil Fuels by Chris Tomlinson, San Antonio Express News.
The race is on to see which companies and countries can produce the greenest fossil fuels, and Texas is falling behind. In Riyadh, Paris, and Washington, business executives and government officials are no longer talking about whether oil, natural gas, and coal cause climate change. Instead, they are talking about who produces the cleanest version of those fossil fuels. Marketers call this process product differentiation. The company or region that can claim to produce the cleanest dirty energy would end up the last one standing as the world adopts cleaner alternatives wherever possible. Even in a much smaller market, oil and natural gas survivors will be profitable because there are some things clean technology cannot replace. I first heard about green oil 2 years ago when Saudi Arabian officials started talking about how few greenhouse gases they emit while producing their crude. A Stanford-led study found that because Saudi Aramco does not hydraulically fracture its wells and only rarely flares excessive gases, Saudi Arabia has the least impact on the climate. Add in the world's lowest lifting costs, and Saudi oil becomes the logical choice for the European Union and other nations that will soon levy a tariff on petroleum imports based on their carbon intensity. As long as the right policies are in place, competing on carbon intensity will give you a higher share of the market, Jim Crane, an energy fellow at Rice University's Baker Institute, predicted. Countries and companies that produce the really high carbon intensity crudes are going to have a really hard time. The American Petroleum Institute, the industry's top lobbying body in Washington, recently argued that the Biden administration should boost domestic production because U.S. environmental laws are stricter than most. The administration is leading us toward more reliance on foreign energy from countries with lower environmental standards, API President Mike Summers said in a statement denouncing a ban on new leases on federal lands. API, though, has vehemently opposed stricter environmental standards, including new limits on flaring and methane emissions. Foreign leaders, meanwhile, consider U.S. environmental regulations lacking. In October, the French government forced Paris-based energy company Engie to break off negotiations for a $7 billion liquefied natural gas export deal with NextDecade Corp. The contract was critical for NextDecade to attract financing for a new LNG export facility near Brownsville. President Emmanuel Macron and French environmentalists said Engie should not buy natural gas from fracked wells in the Permian Basin, where flaring is out of control. Unless NextDecade can find other customers, it'll have to scratch the project. Most governments are looking for ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to meet their obligations under the Paris Climate Agreement. The Biden administration plans to tighten rules for flaring and also order pipeline companies to plug leaks. Responsible oil and gas companies, particularly supermajors such as ExxonMobil, Chevron, and BP, support tighter regulation. They know consumers want the industry to clean itself up. Reducing flaring also makes financial sense. In a study financed by the Environmental Defense Fund, energy experts at Riyadh Consulting calculated that companies could generate $440 million in additional revenue a year by 2025 if they spent $50 million to capture 98% of the methane coming out of their wells. Governor Greg Abbott, though, is determined to make sure Texas producers end up blackballed. His latest political stunt was visiting an oil field service center in Odessa to order state agencies and lawmakers to fight all efforts to reduce emissions. Thanks, Governor. You pretty much guaranteed European and Asian nations will shop for their liquefied natural gas elsewhere. The Texas Railroad Commission, which regulates the oil and gas industry, has also decided to tell off the Europeans rather than reduce flaring. Terrible climate accords, bad investment decisions, and contract cancellations. This is what radical environmentalism gets us, Commissioner Wayne Christen wrote in an over-the-top response to France's decision. Natural gas is clean, reliable, and affordable. Why is that no longer good enough? Well, because energy markets are shifting under public pressure to become more environmentally responsible. Governments, particularly Texas officials, can help by imposing transparent regulations and an emission reduction certification process. Otherwise, producers like Saudi Arabia will take an ever-increasing share of a slowly shrinking market. If Texas wants to remain an energy exporter, it must give customers what they want. And when there are no alternatives, they want demonstrably cleaner fossil fuels. This is the obituary column for Wednesday, February 10th, 2021. Anthony W. Pacheco Lozoya. Anthony W. Pacheco Lozoya, 57, passed away Saturday, February 6, 2021, in Midland, Texas. Anthony was born in Pueblo, Colorado, on February 15, 1963. He later moved to Stanton, Texas, with his family. Anthony is survived by his girlfriend, Deborah Cervantes, biological father, Ray Pacheco, three sisters, Mona Lerma and spouse Ruben, Sherry Correa and spouse Celestino, Desiree Pacheco, two nieces, Dana Martinez and spouse Robert Rios, Demarie Gonzalez and spouse G. Garcia, two nephews, Daniel Lopez, spouse Beverly, and Christopher Lopez, nine great-nieces, eight great-nephews, and one great-great-nephew. Anthony was preceded in death by his father, Frank Lozoya, mother, Violet Lozoya, brother, Ray Pacheco Jr., aunts Lydia Lozoya, Angelita Lozoya, niece Monica Lopez, and nephew Salvador Chava Martinez. Viewing will begin at 9 a.m. Wednesday, February 10th, followed by a chapel service at 2 p.m. at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home Chapel, 1502 North La Mesa Road. Arrangements are entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Edward Kekel. Edward Kekel died on Sunday, January 24th, from complications from COVID-19. Ed was born on April 2nd, 1932, in the Black Hills country of Dante, South Dakota, to Albert and Mary Papasil Kekel. Ed is preceded in death by his parents, three brothers, one sister, and dear friends Ann and Chris Stallings. Visitation will be held at Ellis Funeral Home on Tuesday, February 9th from 5 to 7 p.m. with a rosary at 6 p.m. Graveside burial will be held at Rest Haven Memorial Park on Wednesday, February 10th at 3 p.m. Linda Mae Lawson Scarpelli. Linda Mae Lawson Scarpelli was surrounded by her family when she left this world to enter into eternal peace with our Heavenly Father on February 7th, 2021. Born on January 19th, 1942, in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, to Herman and Marie Lawson, Linda settled in Midland, Texas. Linda is survived by her four daughters, Sharon, John Glidwell, Vicki Thurman Ragsdale, Cindy Steve Cummings, and Amy Scott Braley, 11 grandchildren, son-in-law Billy Wayne Busby, 10 great-grandchildren, her loving companion John Cox, Sandy, her sweet and sassy dachshund, her sisters Nancy and Debbie, and families. Linda was preceded in death by her parents, Herman and Marie Lawson, grandson Jake Lawson Busby, and her husband Victor Scarpelli. For those that knew and loved Linda, please join us for a celebration of life at 12 p.m. Friday, February 12th at the Nellie Pickelin Wells Funeral Home Chapel in Midland. Interment will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. The service will be available to be viewed online at www.livestream.com/npw. Arrangements have been entrusted to Nellie Pickelin Wells Funeral Home and Crematory in Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Teresa Maria Flores.
Teresa Maria Flores, 65, of Midland, passed away Thursday, February 4th, peacefully at her home, surrounded by her loved ones. She was born July 17, 1955, in Slayton, Texas, to Jesus Ledesma and Andrea Tovar. Teresa was preceded in death by her husband, Adam Flores, her brothers, Jerry Ledesma and Gilbert Ledesma, and by her paternal and maternal grandparents. She is survived by her parents, Jesus and Andrea Ledesma of Abernathy, Texas, daughters Andrea Galindo and husband Rudy of Midland, Texas, and Selena Flores of Midland, Texas, son Brian Flores and wife Crystal of Midland. 9 grandchildren, 1 great-grandchild, sisters Estela Constancia, Vicenta Rodriguez, Sylvia Cabello, and Laura Ledesma, brothers Richard Ledesma, Jesse Ledesma, Ralph Ledesma, and Andy Ledesma. She was loved by so many and will be greatly missed. Funeral services for Teresa were held at 2 p.m. Monday, February 8th at Willowbrook Funeral Home Chapel with Jesse Arispe officiating. Burial followed at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Services entrusted to Willowbrook Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Midland. To place online condolences, please visit www.willowbrk.com. Death notices. Brenda Jackson, 62, passed away February 3rd. Visitation will be held Friday, February 12th from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Cremation to follow. Survivors include her daughter, Brandy Jackson, son, Brennan Jackson, 7 sisters, and 1 brother. Arrangements are entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Michael Mayo. Michael Mayo, 50, of Brownfield, passed away February 4th. Service will be held at a later date. Survivors include mother, Donna Mayo. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Sergio Yoregi. Sergio Yoregi, 52, passed away February 7th. Visitation will be held Thursday, February 11th from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. A rosary will be recited at 6 p.m. at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Survivors include his wife, Maria Porras, daughters Aliego Yoregi, Alejandro Yoregi, son Axel Alejandro Yoregi, 4 sisters and 5 brothers. Arrangements are entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Valencia Kirby. Valencia Kirby, 72, of Stanton, passed away Monday, February 8th. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, February 10th, at the Greenwood Church of Christ, located at 9501 FM 307, Midland, Texas, 79706. Survivors include mother Jackie Conway, husband Danny Kirby, son Lanny Kirby, and daughter Carrie Leonard. Arrangements are under the direction of Gilbreth Funeral Home of Stanton. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com.
This is the Odessa American for Wednesday, February 10th, 2021. Senate agrees to hear Trump case. Acquittal likely. The caption reads, in this image from video, Bruce Castor, an attorney for former President Donald Trump, speaks during the second impeachment trial of Trump in the Senate at the U.S. Capitol Tuesday in Washington. Written by the Associated Press. Washington. Donald Trump's historic second impeachment trial opened Tuesday with graphic video showing the former president whipping up a rally crowd to march to the Capitol and fight like hell against his re-election defeat, followed by images of the deadly attack on Congress that came soon after. In an early test of the former president's defense, Trump's team lost a critical bid to halt the trial on constitutional grounds. Senators confirmed 56 to 44, their jurisdiction over the trial, the first of a president no longer in office. While six Republican senators joined the Democrats in proceeding, the tally showed how fat prosecutors have to go to win conviction, which requires a two-thirds threshold of 67 senators. Tuesday's vote was on whether a former president could be tried after leaving office. House Democrats prosecuting the case told senators they were representing cold, hard facts against Trump, who is charged with inciting the mob siege of the Capitol to overturn the election he lost to Democratic Joe Biden. Senators sitting as jurors, many who themselves fled for safety that day, watched the jarring video of Trump supporters battling past police to storm the halls, Trump flags waving. That's high crime and misdemeanor, declared Republican Jamie Raskin, Democrat of Maryland. In opening remarks, if that's not an impeachable offense, then there's no such thing. Trump is the first president to face impeachment charges after leaving office and the first to be twice impeached. The Capitol siege stunned the world as hundreds of rioters ransacked the building to try to stop the certification of Biden's victory, a domestic attack on the nation's seat of government unlike any in its history. Five people died. Acquittal is likely, but the trial will test the nation's attitude toward Trump's brand of presidential power, the Democrats' resolve in pursuing him, and the loyalty of Trump's Republican allies defending him. Trump's lawyers are insisting that he is not guilty of the sole charge of incitement of insurrection. His fiery words, just a figure of speech as he encouraged a rally crowd to fight like hell for his presidency. But prosecutors say he has no good defense, and they promise new evidence. Security remained extremely tight at the Capitol on Tuesday, a changed place after the attack, fenced off with razor wire with armed National Guard troops on patrol. The nine House managers walked across the shuttered building to prosecute the case before the Senate. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Biden would not be watching the trial of his predecessor. Joe Biden is the president. He's not a pundit. He's not going to opine on back-and-forth arguments, she said. Freezing fog rolls through Basin. The caption reads, pump jacks are seen in the morning fog in an oil field Tuesday near FM 1788. National Weather Service issued a freezing fog advisory for much of the Permian Basin, including Odessa and Midland County, at 9:55 a.m., and was in effect until 1 p.m. Tuesday. Freezing temperatures over much of the Permian Basin, with visibility down to a fourth mile in spots, allowed for a potential thin layer of ice from freezing fog, according to NWS. Arctic Air on the Way by Michael Barr. The warm weather that Odessans enjoyed these past few days is going to gradually disappear this week as Arctic air pushes its way across the central parts of the country, including West Texas. According to the National Weather Service, the Arctic air mass will make its way into the Permian Basin, with the worst conditions expected to be late this week and into next week. We have an Arctic air mass that's trying to push in over the next several days. Senior forecaster of the National Weather Service in Midland, Greg Murdoch, said, once it does push in, it could stay until next Tuesday morning. Tuesday's temperature was mostly in the 60s and 70s, but over the next few days, Odessaans can expect to bundle up. Thursday and Friday, we'll see the highs mostly in the 40s with the lows in the 20s. Saturday's high is expected to be 39 degrees and as low as 13. We'll see our temperatures slowly cool off through Friday and then Friday night. The strong push is going to occur and we're going to see our temperatures taking an abrupt fall, Murdoch said. After that, people will be expected to brace for the single-digit temperatures, according to Murdoch. Right now, into Saturday, we could see low temperatures into the low 20s at the most on Saturday, and then on Sunday, low temperatures could be in the lower to mid-teens, Murdoch said. Sunday could see 10 degrees. Monday, the lows could be colder or similar to Sunday, maybe 9 degrees. The initial cold front is expected to arrive this evening, and freezing drizzle and fog may affect the northeast Permian Basin on Thursday morning. Wintry precipitation will be possible across the Permian Basin on Sunday, but Murdoch said it's still up in the air about how much snow accumulation will be expected in the region. We are concerned about that, Murdoch said. The next couple of mornings are going to be fog and freezing fog and freezing drizzle, especially in the early morning hours. But come late Sunday and Monday, we are concerned that we can see accumulating snow across the Permian Basin. We're still watching that. That's still 6 days out. But some of the latest data that we're looking at is accumulating snow fall Sunday night into Monday. Regardless, Murdoch says people should still be cautious of freezing fog, which is when tiny, super cold liquid water droplets in fog can freeze instantly on exposed surfaces when surface temperatures are at or below freezing, which should be expected throughout the next couple of days. It does two things. It reduces visibility to less than a quarter mile, just like it does with warm air fog. So you have that concern when driving, Murdoch said. Visibility may change in short distances. Also, since the air temperature is below 32 degrees, exposed surfaces may be below freezing, and once that fog touches that exposed surface, you start to get light ice. So there could be a lot of ice and accumulation on exposed surfaces, including bridges and overpasses, steps leading up to buildings, and stuff like that. That's the main concern. While it's not unusual to see cold weather conditions in the month of February, including the Permian Basin, the cause of this has been from a building surface anti-cyclone from the Yukon, according to Murdoch. We're seeing this surface high continually feeding this cold air in the Rockies and continuing to slide down over the next several days, Murdoch said. As we get several disturbances that move across, they open up the doors for the air to move further and further, so that's what we're looking at. It's not uncommon for February for it to be brutally cold. Our coldest on record in Midland in February was in 1933 and 1985 when it got to minus 11 degrees. Compared to other parts in Texas, including the Panhandle, the Permian Basin might get off a little easy this week, and next week where the high in Amarillo is expected to be 10 degrees on Sunday and 20 on Monday. It's certainly going to be colder up in the panhandle, Murdoch said. For example, some of the data shows that the low temperatures on Sunday and Monday mornings could be below zero in the panhandle, and high temperatures on Saturday in the Amarillo area could be single digits. As for when the Permian Basin can expect the thermostat to show 70 degrees again, that might not be until late next week at the earliest. Not for a while, Murdoch said. This cold weather could give way to warmer conditions next week, but it doesn't look like it'll be warm enough at least until next Thursday when it gets into the 70s. With the upcoming cold front expected to pass through this weekend, Texas Department of Transportation crews have been busy preparing roads across the 12-county Odessa district for the upcoming weather, according to a press release on Tuesday. The release stated that crews began treating roads with brine water on Tuesday and will continue to do so today. Since water is possible, some of the brine used to pre-treat the roads may be washed away. Drivers are urged to drive as if nothing has been pre-treated. Any moisture on the road could freeze. Not every road on the state system will be pre-treated. Likewise, cities and counties don't have the resources to treat all of their roads. Motorists are urged to avoid travel if necessary and use extreme caution if traveling is necessary. While the National Weather Service is predicting low temperatures across the district, precipitation amounts won't be uniform. Every motorist must access the local conditions. Driving conditions across the state can be found at www.drivetexas.org.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.